Governor David Ige just finished delivering his 2018 State of the State address. It's an election year, and he's been under fire all week by state lawmakers and our congressional delegation over the missile alert scare. Joining us in the studio this morning is HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, with a recap. Surprise. No mention.
Yeah, exactly. Talk about the elephant in the room, and we're not talking about Republicans in an election year, that no mention of the false missile alert, no sort of floating of any balloons around that at all. No mention of what may or may not happen in terms of a review, an investigation, anything in terms of safety, even something, general, the safety of the people of the state is of paramount importance, something like that. Wasn't there.
Did it surprise you?
You know, Bill, he could easily have accomplished the goal you just described with a few sentences. It wouldn't have cost him anything. But I think people, I suspect the people of Hawaii were waiting to hear some declaration of intention about change.
You know, it's interesting. State of the State, and again, similar to State of the Union addresses, it's you generally think of them if they have affirmations of shared values, of here's what we share, here's what we bring together to the table. Aspirations, a little bit of here's what we want to do, here's my vision, here's my leadership, and a bit of achievements. Here's what we have done. Here is, in terms of the leadership, this is what this has produced. Again, to not even address this in any way was, I got to say, sort of a gaping hole.
Well, he did talk about homelessness and housing, which is what state lawmakers in their opening day of the session said, yeah, that's a priority. We want to put more money toward this. And so we'll see if what he's allocated in his budget is enough or how lawmakers will fine-tune that.
Trouble with both those issues, homelessness and housing, is that they're likely to lead to an unsatisfactory conclusion. They're problems that are just so huge that it really has always taxed the capacity of government to handle them.
Well, in specifics, again, there are two ways to go in terms of a state of a state, in terms of also for lawmakers, for that matter, in terms of the opening day. You can lay out some specifics, the framework to be worked out later, but you can also talk more in generalities. This, I think, was more in terms of generalities. And, of course, we've been talking about how it's an election year. This is sort of a setting a stage for that. But you have the legislative session, and that generally, again, in terms of state of the state, he's addressing the people of the state of Hawaii, certainly, but also lawmakers in terms of here is where the executive branch is laying out the direction for the session itself.
He did underscore his commitment to renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about plans to restart those solar farms that we've had in the pipeline for some time. But not much more than that.
And, in a general bit of a laundry list, and you always get laundry lists in speeches like this, but within there you had a mention of seawater air conditioning, which has not made progress to the same extent that wind and solar certainly has. Again, maybe that's one of the aspirational goals, but in terms of specifics, that is a deliverable in the short to medium term, maybe not so much on that one specifically.
They do seem, with regard to the whole emergency planning thing, the governor's office does seem to be adopting a strategy of, let's move on. If we don't talk about it, maybe people won't bother us about it. I'm not sure how that's going to play.
Well, to be fair, there are investigations that are going on. And
right.
And that, to give those a chance to play out is definitely, you can see that as, okay, fair enough. But the idea that to have some mention of this, I mean, the risk is that when you're in politics and government, as you both know, the risk is when you are off note with your audience, and if there's a tone that you miss, and it's back, you think of George H.W. Bush back to at the grocery store checkout. Oh, barcodes, what are these?
Yeah.
And it's that distance from the electorate. I think that's what's at risk right now when it comes to the handling of the emergency alert.
It's a perception game, right? You're creating a perception. You might make you know, pie in the sky promises, but that's kind of what people expect to hear in a speech of this kind.
It is, and again, there are themes. You know, it's interesting. Last year, some of the themes: transforming schools, reshaping the economy to allow innovation, more affordable homes, and addressing homelessness, and making government more efficient and effective. Certainly, heard some echoes of those this year. Back a couple of years ago, in terms of mentioning homelessness as a complex and difficult issue, certainly echoes of that as well. Again, as we head into the session, there is the point of the speech that sets that up, but there's also the substance that carries through in terms of where we go with legislation.
Right, and education, he didn't really address too much aside from the cooling off the classrooms, you know, and then just saying we've got the blueprint for education and they've got to run with it now, but not much else.
And on that, you know, again, this idea of what's become a tradition in both State of the States and States of the Union of recognizing people who have made achievements and oftentimes who have benefited from certain policies or ideas of an administration. We saw a bit of that, certainly, but again, not a lot that takes you a great deal forward. I think fair to say I don't think that there's anything shocking in this. I don't know if either of you found anything particularly surprising.
It's pretty unusual to write a story about a speech where your lead is what he didn't say.
Mm.
And that's the lead of today's speech, in my view anyway.
He didn't also talk about the issues with the tax modernization project and how that's kind of languished. And, you know, it's a lot of taxpayers' money that went into that. And it's, you know, it's proven to be a pretty bumpy ride. So I was kind of disappointed that he didn't address that and how he plans to fix it going forward.
And that's, again, in terms of the finance, you know, when you can lead with the bond rating of the state being in good shape, I mean, yes, that is financially, that is not insignificant at all because that does reduce borrowing costs and it's a very important piece of the finance puzzle. But we didn't hear much beyond that in terms of financing plans and in terms of, again, specificity. And it's not that you are always looking in a state of the state for a play-by-play of the entire legislative session, but some inkling, some idea in terms of that on the financing side. Was a little surprised we didn't hear a bit more on that.
You know, if you just look at the text of the speech, an awful lot of, at least in the early paragraphs, they're pretty boilerplate in the sense that they could have been a speech from 20 or even 30 years ago. We have led the nation in health insurance, one of the healthiest states in the nation. We are our host culture, gifts of aloha, tolerance, and respect. That's not tied to any particular time or...
I thought one interesting point that he got applause on a few lines, and one of the biggest applause lines was Hawaii will not stand for the hateful and hurtful policies of the Trump White House.
Yeah.
Mentioning Trump crept in at a couple of places, and that was well received.
All right, Bill Dorman, thank you for joining us in the studios. Our political reporter, Wayne Yoshioka, will have reaction to the speech later on today on Hawaii Public Radio. This is The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the economics of home battery systems. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a creature that's native to Hawaiian waters, even if it's rarely seen. One reason they're not found that often is their camouflage, because they're not that large and don't swim very fast. Nature provides them with protective coloration that makes them hard to spot. When a predator is around, they remain very still, blending in easily with their surroundings. The local species ranges from 3 to 6 inches in length and does not have the armor-like covering many of its closest evolutionary cousins have. Both its English and Latin names make reference to its unusual appearance. Latin names for the species are drawn from the name of a monster in Greek mythology and are also used as a scientific name for a portion of the brain which has a similar shape. We'll take either the common English or Latin names for this all-too-rare critter. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Mita Chesney Lynn from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it at the Apple App Store or Google Play.
For many consumers in sunny Hawaii, solar-generated electricity seems like a no-brainer, but there are two major problems. The sun isn't always shining, and even when it is, peak electricity demand happens in the evening hours. To address these issues, several companies now produce home battery systems that can be connected to a residential photovoltaic, or PV, solar system. These battery systems allow electricity generated during the day to be used at night, but they aren't cheap. Aida Eric is a Ph.D. candidate in economics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She conducted a study examining the economics of residential solar in Hawaii. Conversation producer Ryan Finity sat down with her to find out if those expensive battery systems can save consumers money over time.
So, Aida, can you give us a brief overview of what systems are involved in generating your own electricity from the sun?
Well, since the net energy metering program sunsetted in 2015, the utility offers grid supply where a household, a residential household, can export their solar-generated energy back to the grid at a PUC-approved credit. The other option is customer self-supply, where customer installs PV, photovoltaic, and a battery, and uses the grid as a backup.
What is net energy metering? You mentioned that.
Net energy metering was a program where customers who installed PV could export back to the grid at the full retail price of electricity.
So you generate it from the sun with panels on your property and sell it straight into the grid.
Right.
And we no longer do that.
Well, the options are now grid supply, which is similar but a different price credit, and then also customer self-supply.
Okay. And so your paper looks at the difference between having a home solar system, PV or photovoltaic, and having a photovoltaic system with a battery backup. Can you explain briefly what the difference between those two setups are?
Well, the idea is just to understand what's the benefit of putting in a battery, because we know that batteries cost a lot of money. The price is dropping all the time, but it's still quite a bit of money to put out. So the idea is just whether it's cost effective for a household, an average household in Honolulu, to install the battery.
So a photovoltaic system by itself is fairly expensive, and
sure,
one of these battery systems even adds more to that cost. So how does the battery help you save money in the long run?
it goes to the timing of solar generation. So imagine that you work during the daytime. That's when the sun is out. So if you have a battery installed, that solar energy that's being generated is being stored while you're away. And then you come home, make dinner, that's the peak energy time. And if you have the battery installed, then you are offsetting the cost of pulling from the grid. So that becomes your savings if you have the storage.
Okay, so if you don't have a battery system, all the electricity you're generating during the day is really just sort of going to waste. It's not being consumed.
Right. If you're not able to consume it, it's just going to waste.
Okay. And so that's where the battery system comes in. So you can now store it and then use it when it's dark outside or maybe when it's cloudy and the sun's not shining.
Yeah.
Okay. And so over time, that can help you save because you're not having to buy as much electricity from the utility.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, so the next thing you looked at was when is the best time over the next few years to install one of these battery systems? Can you explain some of the variables involved with that timing?
Sure. Well, with the caveat that anytime we look at future projections, there are uncertainties involved. But we looked at the electricity cost projected scenario for that, as well as the cost of batteries, which are declining pretty rapidly. And then the other factor is the federal subsidy. So right now it's a 30% tax credit for a PV system, which includes a battery if you install it. And that is set to decline and eventually go away by 2022. So the question I was asking is, what happens once that subsidy starts declining? Is it still worth it? And is it even better to wait maybe another year if battery costs are declining?
So what did you find?
Well, given that the federal subsidy starts going down in 2020, probably best to install by 2019. That's when you might maximize your savings if you're an average household.
So approximately how much money are we talking about?
Again, with a lot of caveats with this analysis, the savings would range from maybe 17 to 32% from the 2017 numbers. But that's assuming that you're an average household, that you're not changing your electricity usage at all. So there's a lot of factors that come into that number.
Okay, so 17 to 32% of the total cost, that's the panels and the battery system. Is that right?
Yeah, it's an additional savings. So
okay, so on top of what you're getting from having those. What is the approximate cost of installing one of these in an average household?
Well, for my analysis, I looked at the price of the battery being $10,000. But when you talk to companies, they might say it's more towards $11,000 to $12,000 for the battery system, including the hardware and install. The solar panels cost like $5 per watt. It's quite a capital investment.
And as you said, the price of those batteries is not fixed. That's right now declining every year.
Yeah. In the literature, that's what we see, is that that cost is declining all the time.
So you mentioned that federal subsidy, which works out to be a pretty significant percentage of the cost of installing one of these battery systems. When that sunsets in 2022, as it's set to now, is it still economically viable? Do you still see savings in installing one of these systems?
No, not according to my analysis, which is why it's important for the state and the utility to think about incentive programs that might encourage households to want to install solar or solar PV systems with the battery, given that the federal subsidy is looking like it's going away.
And did your analysis include any look at how these battery systems influence overall electricity consumption at the residential level?
I didn't go that far with this analysis. I assume that the household is going to demand the same over time, which is already a kind of a hefty assumption. But just for the purpose of getting at these numbers and starting this conversation, that's what I assumed.
And is there a significant difference in savings for a household that just puts in panels versus one that does panels and a battery system? How long does it take for that additional, you said $10,000 to $12,000 for a battery? How long does it take for a house to start seeing savings?
It actually saves the household more if they install the battery, if they're under this customer self-supply program, because you're able to avoid the cost of buying electricity. It's pretty quick savings that you start realizing. So if you're under this customer self-supply program with the utility, then it makes sense to install the battery.
Okay, so the bottom line, if you're thinking about installing one of these systems, best to do it before 2022.
Right.
Okay. Ida, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Ida Eric is a doctoral candidate in economics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You can find a link to her paper on the residential solar market in Hawaii on today's edition of the Conversation Podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a science symposium for girls in grades 5 to 8, Saturday, February 17th. Registration at sacredhearts.org/symposium.
In times of budget constraints and government cutbacks, it's troubling to hear of federal funding being squandered by the city and county of Honolulu, but that's how the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is characterizing the city's handling of funds intended for affordable housing and neighborhood revitalization. Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Anita, I can barely hear you.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Much better. Yeah. Troubling to hear of empty space, for one thing, in an area where space is at such a premium. But what happened here?
Well, what happened was that the federal government conducted a monitoring report of one particular grant called the Community Development Block Grant Program.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that the city and county wasted $10 million on vacant projects, essentially.
And facilities that stayed vacant for years, according to your story.
Yes, in some cases, there were facilities that were empty for 4 years or even longer. And in one instance, when federal inspectors showed up to look at a property, the building was empty and overgrown.
Well, you know, given that, is the city going to have to give money back? Who has oversight over all this?
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has oversight over this, and what they've done is they've identified four projects that the city needs to put back into production by March, or they're going to have to pay back some of that money. And so in one instance, the city has decided to go ahead and give back thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, for one project that they're just planning to tear down. But in three other instances, there's a lot more money involved, and the city's trying to find ways to lease that property by March.
Anita, these are buildings that are owned by the city. What was the intention? Let me put it that way.
The intentions vary because the grant can be used for a lot of different things. But in one instance, a project was supposed to be used for an adult daycare program. In another instance, we're talking about commercial space in Chinatown, the Chinatown Gateway Plaza. Mm-hmm. And this HUD found that most of that commercial space was sitting empty. And so in that case, they were supposed to be using that project to revitalize Chinatown, which is a lower moderate income community.
These are areas in which we've certainly heard government make a great many promises. We're going to use community development block grants to revitalize neighborhoods and things like that. You would think that a lot of energy would be expended to make these things happen.
And yes, and that's not the only problem. The city also needs to pay back more than $8,000 for administrative costs. They used the grant money for administrative costs that didn't actually qualify. And so there's a lot of changes that need to be made in order to ensure that the city won't be on the hook for millions.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this story plays out, Anita. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's Reality Check.
Swing to the Latin and salsa rhythms of Freddie Miranda Jr., drummer and percussionist extraordinaire, and his quintet of all-stars. Make your reservations today for their Atherton studio debut on January 27th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for the Freddie Miranda Jr. Quintet. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It was almost 2 years ago that Hawaiian Electric canceled three large solar projects started by the now bankrupt company Sun Edison. Those three solar farms here on Oahu are being kick-started by NRG Energy, which bought out the Sun Edison projects worth an estimated $350 million. Those projects at Kōʻailoa, Mililani, and Waipio will generate 110 megawatts of solar energy, enough to power 18,000 homes. Joining us this morning is NRG's Craig Cornelius.
We've already started construction at all three of the solar facilities, and at that, ahead of the schedule that we'd set for ourselves and with HECO, when we had the opportunity to take custody of projects in the fall of 2016. So the construction activities are underway, and I think the goal is for them to be in service and producing power, all of them, during the first half of 2019, and given the pace that we've been able to work with our own construction firms and all the applicable permitting agencies within the state and the speed that HECO's been working to, I think we're feeling quite good about the timetable we're working to under those projects.
Now, I know Sun Edison had already put in some of the infrastructure and had some of the panels up at that one solar farm in central Oahu. Did you have to replace everything?
Yeah, in point of fact, I think, you know, we, with the time, the intervening time between when the projects had originally started construction and when we did, we'd concluded that the long-term reliability of the plants and the cost structure for the ratepayers would both be best served by our kind of starting anew in terms of the ground-up construction at the sites and bringing new equipment in for panels. And so we've done all that. And the result is a pretty meaningful reduction in the price per kilowatt hour from the contracts that were originally in place, and equipment that that now has been designed to withstand the environment there in Oahu for the full projected service life of those plants that we hope will be generating power there within the state long past the end of the contract period for, you know, more than three decades.
So is it a better deal?
Yeah, I think it's a better deal for the ratepayers for sure. I mean, part of the public filings outlined this, but, you know, at 10.8 cents per kilowatt hour on a blended average basis, the price of power from these plants is, you know, amongst the lowest costs achieved for generation within the state to date. And it's certainly a good bit lower than the original contracts on those. And, you know, we were excited to get to do that because, you know, that additional time let us deploy those enhanced technologies, but also because, you know, the statement that the state's made in terms of national leadership around renewable deployment, both being a good objective unto its own, but also being a sensible economic objective, needs people like us to help make each step on the path towards 100% renewables be a cost-effective one. So, we were pleased to be able to drop the cost of power from these plants as much as we did. And, you know, amongst the ways we were able to do that was by employing new equipment and new construction methods, which is what's at work out there at the three sites today in Hawaii.
Now, I know we visited farms where they were breeding sheep with the plan that the sheep would basically keep the grass down. What's in place going forward for these three solar farms?
Yeah, that actually is a part of the site plan for some of these, and I think we'd be glad maybe subsequent to this call to try to help put you in touch with some of the other stakeholders who'd give you, you know, that local picture. But you know, I think we were mindful as we got the opportunity to become custodians of these projects, of the sort of integrated sustainability objectives that all the stakeholders around these facilities have, and in particular the philosophies that the Kamehameha Schools foundations have around land use planning, supporting multiple uses and multiple benefit streams for the community. So vegetation control and for a good portion of the acreage of these projects will be through that kind of cheap grazing. The name of the species I can't recall, but they are they're distinctive for their height, among other things, which is helpful in allowing them to come along underneath the height of the solar arrays. And we've been thoughtful about other aspects of site use to make sure that, you know, these sites fit into the rest of the uses adjacent to them. And, you know, I think the experiences that we've had with all the adjacent stakeholders have been pretty positive so far.
Right. The Kōʻailoa Solar Project, I know, I think is located near where there's a sheep farm. And fascinating. I mean, you know, the way it was explained to me, well, you know, if you use cows or cattle, they might, you know, bump up against the panels. And if you use goats, they might jump on the panels. It was interesting to hear the stories behind why sheep work and another type of animal doesn't.
Yeah, well, and I think throughout the fleet that we have in the continental U.S., we've learned a lot about how to sort of get to the best outcomes in terms of agricultural uses sort of adjacent to or coincident with, you know, both our wind and solar facilities. And it's not, you know, you learn things like you just said by experience, and, you know, there are other things, for example, that we've done in the design of these plants to enable that by changing, you know, the selection of cabling and bearing it and things like that. So fortunately, you know, part of what we're hoping to bring to bear in Oahu through construction of these projects is some of the experiences that we've had in the continental U.S. And as an example for that, actually something also that we'd arranged with the Kamehameha Schools is that we'll be bringing, career development opportunities to people in Hawaii to come back and learn more about how we operate and construct facilities here in the United States, with the hope that both what we do there on the island in constructing these facilities and then running them, but also the experience we've been developing here in the continental United States can be transmitted to people there within the state, both, you know, to help with the operations of these first three projects, but lay a foundation for more to be built over time there within all the islands of Hawaii.
Craig Cornelius is president of NRG Renewables, LLC. He'll be on hand Wednesday at a ceremonial groundbreaking here on Oahu. Again, those solar projects expected to be online starting in 2019.
Aloha, I'm Benny Rietveld from Honolulu, Hawaii, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, as well as what we can look for in our dark island skies, turning to the considerable expertise of Christopher Phillips, welcoming him back. Now, hey, Christopher, how you doing? What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, all visible during dawn in our early morning island skies. Moon this week will be approaching its full phase by week's end, so expect stargazing for those faint objects to be a little tricky.
And this week, we have an update on a story that we've followed for some time, and this is about the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yes, it's that time at last. It feels like we've been waiting years for this, and indeed we have. Last week, the James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST as it's more commonly known, reached an important milestone in its final journey to the launch pad. The JWST has been undergoing a series of extreme temperature tests designed to test the spacecraft's ability to survive the cold and inhospitable environment of deep space. The spacecraft was sealed in a specially designed chamber at NASA that is able to mimic the extreme cold to which the JWST and its sensitive instruments will be exposed.
And how cold is that?
Well, inside this chamber, JWST was subject to temperatures of around minus 250 degrees Celsius. That's pretty cold by mine and your standards. Definitely not shorts and t-shirt weather.
And this thing is going to be, that temperature is different than if it was in a close Earth orbit?
If it was in a closer orbit to the Earth, then yes, indeed, things would be a little warmer.
But it would still be real nippy up there. And so where do they put that thing? Does it sit in one stationary spot?
It's going to sit in one spot, but this spot is about 1 million miles away from the Earth. It's in a special place where the gravitational forces of the Earth, Moon, and Sun cancel out. We call it a Lagrange point. This is a great place to do astronomy, but also makes repair difficult because it's a million miles away. So everything has to work perfectly.
And a million miles away, is that four times the distance of the moon?
So it's going to be around four or five.
And so when's the big blast off?
It is set to blast off this October, so not long to go.
All right. And maybe we'll get another update or two in before then as they fine-tune the mission. It's Christopher Phillips, and thank you so much for the update.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for more Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the NOAA Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, Saturday's Ocean Watch column in the Star Advertiser told of a rare sighting of one of these creatures, and it's a shame they're not found more often. Most of us would have to go to the Waikiki Aquarium to see one. It would be well worth it, though, because these animals are unlike any others in the ocean. The Latin name derives from Greek and Roman mythology. It's the name of a monster with the head of a horse. The image appears on coins minted as far back as the 4th century B.C. Homer's Iliad depicts Poseidon, the god of the sea, riding in a chariot drawn by these mythological monsters. Most species of this kind have a kind of armored covering, but Hawaii's endemic version is an exception. That's why it's called the smooth seahorse, or by the Latin name Hippocampus cuda.
And we have a winner. Annie Singh got it right. Annie Singh of Honolulu. This turned out to be a very popular quiz. Lots of calls coming in. We almost stumped you, but not quite. And Kailua resident Carol called in. She says she actually swam with the Hippocampus cuda. That is today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2018 Hawaii Literacy Innovation Conference features Dr. Doug Fisher, January 29th through February 1st. Achieve3000.com/community/events.
Sherlock Holmes didn't like people much, but people sure like him. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's irascible detective continues to fascinate generation after generation as one of the most popular fictional characters ever created. Holmes is also a ripe subject for comedy, which is what he becomes in the Kid Ludwig play Baskerville, currently playing at Mono Valley Theater with an all-female cast. We spoke with director Rob Duval about the unusual character at the heart of it all.
You know, Sherlock, as a person, had a really strange and odd characterization. He would do things very off the cuff. He would make experiments. He dabbled in drugs.
Yeah.
And yet he was still this brilliant detective that everybody wanted to hire for their mysteries that they needed solved.
And yet, you know, he didn't like people very much.
He wasn't a people person. No, yeah. he and that comes through in the play Baskerville. People that come and visit his house and sit in his chair, you can see very disdainfully he looks at them and asks them to leave pretty quickly.
Oh, because that's my chair?
It's my chair. It's my house. I'll contact you tomorrow. Don't worry.
Uh-huh.
Don't question me, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he doesn't have a lot of patience for people, I think, because he's on a different level of thinking.
So what makes him so appealing? You know, he's one of the most recurring characters in all of fiction.
I think because he's unpredictable. We don't know quite how he solves his mysteries, how he gets all of his clues. He's just kind of brilliant, and we don't quite understand his way of thinking sometimes.
We don't ever really catch up with his thought process.
Right. He's always one or two steps ahead of us, yeah, and ahead of the other characters in the books, in the play.
So how does that play out in Baskerville on the stage?
Well, in Baskerville, he sends Watson on the journey to help discover the mystery of why the Baskerville family is being killed off and who's doing the killing. And yet there's always a presence of Holmes throughout, and we're not quite sure about this mystery man that shows up and the letters that Watson writes to Sherlock. So Sherlock still stays involved with the mystery, although he might not always be present at the Baskerville estate, and yet maybe he is. So there's this quality of Holmes where we're not quite sure what he's up to next, and I think that keeps us interested.
One of the things that we're meant to believe about Holmes is that he is a master of disguise.
He is a master of disguise, and that comes through in a lot of the books and in the play as well, yeah.
He can fool even those closest to him.
Correct. Even Watson, you know, his closest confidant.
Well, that poses, for you as a director, that poses a kind of a theatrical, kind of a production challenge, how to make that work, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the main challenges of this show in particular were all of the costume changes. And we go into the play thinking that, oh, well, Sherlock is Sherlock and Watson is Watson, but things aren't always what they seem.
Yeah.
And then we have three other actors who play all of the other roles. And that's part of the fun of the show is seeing how fast their costume changes are and the different characterizations they come up with.
Who are some of the other characters? This is the Baskerville family.
We have some of the Baskerville family. So it begins with Sir Charles Baskerville, and not giving anything away here, but he's killed off in the first scene. And then that starts the mystery. Dr. Mortimer comes to visit Holmes and ask for his help. We've got Henry Baskerville, the heir to the Baskerville estate, who comes from Texas in the play. And so he comes to inherit all of his money and see his lands. Other characters are his maid and butler, the Barrymores. We've got Stapleton and his sister. A bunch of different characters come out, a nurse, a doctor, a maid.
So this is the whole construct of the English country house. There's staff below stairs.
Yes.
The family above.
Right.
All kinds of hidden currents, usually having to do with inheriting a large sum of money.
Correct, correct. And yet a lot of the play takes place in transition between places. So a lot of traveling occurs from, you know, homes on his residence into the Baskerville estate and Merripit House. So we've got a lot of traveling in the show. They take a taxi cab. They take a trap driver comes on. And so one of the ways we decided to make that travel happen, you know, on a stage.
That was my next question.
Is a rotating turntable.
Uh-huh.
So just about every time they have to travel to the train station or from the train to the next place, we have the turntable rotating. And that becomes kind of a character in the show where sometimes the turntable will rotate and sometimes the characters think the turntable is supposed to rotate and it doesn't. There's a lot of there's a lot of theatricality in the play, and the costumes and set kind of become part of it.
Certain amount of fourth wall breaking then?
Quite a bit of fourth wall breaking and in jokes that the audience is in on when the characters talk to each other, reminding each other, and now you're supposed to be someone else. And the character will run off stage. The actor will run off stage, change costumes very quickly, and come back. And the audience is usually pretty awed at that.
You know, I love shows like that because there's a kind of it draws the audience to a kind of complicity
right.
in the events. Right?
right. And we as an audience want to be involved with what's going on. We want to be in on the jokes. So when a character comes on stage late and Holmes says, "Where were you? What was taking so long?" And the actor kind of breaks the fourth wall by saying, "Oh, my gosh, it's so dark backstage. You wouldn't believe it." You know, the audience reacts very vociferously at that.
You know, the whole interaction between Holmes and Watson is really interesting because Watson is meant to be a capable guy.
Right.
You know, he's not a nebbishy sidekick. He's,
correct.
You know, he's a war veteran.
Yeah.
I mean, frequently when Holmes once says, you know, "Come at once, Watson,"
right.
He says, "And bring your revolver."
Right, and bring your revolver. And that's in the play as well. Yeah, make sure you have your revolver day and night. And yet he's a general surgeon. He's not, you know, as adept at solving mysteries as Holmes. But Holmes sends him on this caper just to, you know, maybe test him, see how he's doing. And yet he keeps an eye on him from afar.
You know, the character was supposedly based on a teacher that Conan Doyle had had in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
And who was, you know, a master of deduction. So, you know, I think what most people understand about what deduction is comes from this fictional character. Did you sort of see inside his processes in this show?
I guess, yeah.
Is there some figuring out
to be
done? There's
definitely some figuring out to be done. There's some figuring out by the audience to be done. And we want to stay kind of with Holmes as Holmes is figuring it out. We can never be ahead of Sherlock Holmes. But we can also enjoy his foibles when Holmes isn't quite correct or didn't see something coming and kind of, you know, he'll ashamed himself, you know, for not seeing it coming sooner. We take joy in that too. That he is human.
Oh yeah, you know? he's always chastising himself.
Chastising. That was what I was looking for.
Being so foolish. And now, do we have? I'm hoping Inspector Lestrade makes it.
Lestrade
appearance.
Does make an appearance, and it's funny because the same actress plays Lestrade and Henry Baskerville. So to come up with the difference between, of course, Henry Baskerville from Texas, so easy to do a Texas accent and, you know, have some swagger.
Yeah.
And Lestrade, that was probably the one character we looked at the most, changing the physicality, changing the voice, making him more of a cop from the streets, vulgar language.
Yeah.
Yeah, more grounded and not quite as cerebral.
No, he's meant to be. He's sort of the common sense guy.
Right, yeah.
And he usually disbelieves Holmes.
Disbelieves Holmes. And yet he's useful to be on the case.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah.
You get this feeling that Holmes has a grudging respect for him.
Right, right. There's a line in the play where Holmes says, "Let's hope that he doesn't derail the case this time."
Well, you're having a lot of fun with this show.
Oh, this show is so much fun. You know, we have only five actors playing all of these roles, and they're all women. And that kind of came about from the auditions. I had no idea going in who I would cast. And yet, after all of the auditions, we looked at each other, the production manager and assistant director, and I looked at each other and I said, "The women are so much stronger than the men auditioning. Could we have an all-female cast?" And we tentatively said yes, and I have a connection to the playwright, Ken Ludwig, so I had my friend email Ken Ludwig and ask, would it be all right to do an all-female cast of Baskerville? I know it's never been done. I did all the research on different productions, and he gave us his blessing. So we were very lucky that he came back and said, whatever works best for your show, do it.
Rob Duvall is the director of Baskerville, which runs weekends at Mono Valley Theater until this Sunday. You can learn more on The Conversation's Facebook page. Pretty dramatic music
to
our colleague Derek Malama talking to us about events going on in our community under the radar. And I hope they're as dramatic as that music was.
Hope so. On Tuesday, you can learn about Kilauea's volcanic ash in a Big Island lecture. Pele's hair, Pele's tears, and other ash are produced by these bursting gas bubbles, is what I've learned. in the lava lake at Kilauea's summit. And Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geologist Don Swanson will present this illustrated lecture, and it'll demonstrate how long-term collections of ash can lead to discoveries that are surprising. And this is happening tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium.
Kilauea really is a never-ending source of discoveries.
Oh, yes.
And if you like singing in front of other people, here's a group you can try out for.
I know you like to sing.
Well, people don't really like to listen to it. But
They do. The Hawaii Vocal Arts Ensemble is seeking tenors and basses for the spring season. The 32-voice chamber chorus sings classical, Broadway, and masterworks. Contact them for information and an audition time at HawaiiVocalArts.com, and this is ongoing through February 5th.
So get your vocal chops ready.
Oh, yes.
The Department of Health is offering disaster preparedness information tomorrow in Hilo. That's timely.
Very timely. Jason De La Cruz of the DOH will conduct the presentation. It includes a Q&A session, so please bring your questions. And this disaster preparedness session is from 5 to 6 p.m. tomorrow in the Hilo Public Library, and it's free.
Sounds good, Derek. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Will the Trump administration renew American democracy? This Wednesday, Sokolo Public Square and the Daniel K. Inouye Institute return to Honolulu to explore the possibility of democratic renewal with political journalist and Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion. The free event will be held at Artistry Honolulu in Kaka'ako, moderated by HPR News Director Bill Dorman. Join the discussion. Reservations at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we look at the ways a self-styled education philanthropist hopes to encourage educational reform in Hawaii.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.